Now, whom bot to destroy?
How does it work?
Quite simple. Off, on switches, and the large control here changes the strength of the brain neutralizing beam.
Captain, you remind me of the ancient skeptic who demanded of the wise old sage to be taught all the world's wisdom while standing on one foot.
Beam neutralizing has been experimented with on Earth, Captain. I'm not acquainted with this particular style of equipment, but I can assure you that Dr. Adams has not created a chamber of horrors here.
I didn't mean to suggest that he had. The reason I asked, sir, was you haven't mentioned where Dr. Van Gelder's injury occurred.
Right here, Captain. Yes. Simon was a very stubborn man. He could have sat in that room for years with the beam at that volume, or even higher. Or if he simply had someone standing by to snap it off in case he got into trouble, but no. He tried it alone and on full volume. That's a pity.
Thank you.
You will forget all you have heard, to remember any portion of it, any word, will cause you pain, terrible pain, growing more terrible as you fight to remember.
Hello, and welcome to Whom Bots Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am Terry DeFellin, and I'm joined, as always, by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And by Derek Mantle.
Hello.
How are you doing, chaps?
Fine.
It seems like ages since we were last around this table.
Actually does this time.
Yeah, it does, because it actually has been ages since we were last around this table. The last time we recorded an episode of Whom Bots Destroy was in mid-September.
Wow.
It was just before Discovery came out.
Wow.
All that Discovery has happened.
It did feel like a long time ago.
Yeah. We took October off for reasons. But we're back now. It's mid-November. It's chillier. It's wetter. And we're back to talk about another episode of Star Trek, the original series. This one is from the first season. And it is none other than Dagger of the Mind. Dagger of the Mind, a very memorable episode of the first season, which I will very briefly provide a summary of. Dr. Simon Van Gelder, so of the Tantalus Institute, a prison essentially for the criminally insane, has escaped to the USS Enterprise, who were stopping by to drop off some supplies. And he has a worrying story to tell about the treatment of the prisoners there by the director of the Institute, none other than Dr. Tristan Adams, legendary Dr. Tristan Adams, great leader in his field. So Kirk and a specialist psychiatrist, Dr. Helen Noel, beam down to investigate, and indeed they have found that Dr. Van Gelder's accusations prove to be quite correct, and then a great adventure ensues. Obviously everything is resolved to the satisfaction. If you haven't seen this episode, we'll have spoilers. You might want to quickly watch it if you can beforehand, but any regular listeners will know the form by now. We do spoilers, but if you're a new listener, then just bear that in mind. Right, okay, so Dr. Tristan Adams is probably the first person that I'd like to just talk about here. I think it's quite an interesting, quite prescient, actually. We are, as we're recording this, we're going through a period where there's a significant number of revelations going on in the entertainment industry in the US and in our government here in the UK about harassment, but which ultimately relates to an abuse of power.
Mm.
And I think that there's some significance in that with Dr. Adams, because he is using this neural neutralizer to effectively melt people's brains. And he's being allowed to do it on the basis that everybody thinks he's such a great guy and that he's beyond reproach. And he's abusing his position of trust.
It's a recurring theme in Star Trek, isn't it? Or it becomes a recurring theme. It wasn't a recurring theme when this episode came out, because this episode is very, very early.
Mm.
But we saw it when we did the episode Patterns of Force, didn't we, about a expert in the field who goes a bit nuts, basically, and does things that he really shouldn't be doing, and and end up being taken over by the mistakes that he makes.
Mm.
In this case, the Doctor just basically buys into it completely and thinks he's doing the right thing.
Derek, sorry, does he go nuts? Do you think, or is he, or is he a bad man? Is he a wrong'un? Always been a wrong'un? Is he an abuser who's just a very clever guy?
Well, I'm probably going to go with the old sort of thing where power corrupts, really.
Is he a psychopath? I suppose that's the crux.
He certainly behaves like one, doesn't he? Or yeah. Whether he behaves.
But
like
there is, you know, there's this one. Case of point, you know, sort of where, you know, we have so-called professionals or successful people have a certain part of psychopathic tendencies to actually get where they are.
Really?
Because of, you know,
so-called warrior gene.
Yeah, ooh. Something like that. So it's sort of. So that's quite an interesting point. I was quite interested in a slightly different subtext, which actually goes towards stuff that we've been going on for the last probably 20 or 30 years or even longer, because there was this little bit in the story where you've got the Doctor Adams is coming up with a new treatment, you know, with Van Gelder, and rather than there's a statement from Dr. Noel, and where she mentions about sort of rather than pumping people full of drugs, that they were trying to do a different type of treatment, you know, and how, you know, drugs aren't as good as all that.
Mm.
You remember, sort of, you're going through the stages in the US and, you know, and around the world where drug treatments were coming, you know, being created all the time at this sort of period and all the way up to now.
Mm.
We've got so many drugs.
It's this idea of conditioning, isn't it? Helen Noel actually says when the neural neutralizer is being demonstrated to Captain Kirk, Helen Noel says shifting of memory patterns is basic to psychotherapy.
Mm.
I wonder if that is actually genuinely the case or whether that was just something that the writer just came up with, or the idea of perhaps suppressing memories. I don't know. That strikes me that modern psychotherapy seems to be more focused on allowing people to manage their trauma.
But there was a case in the early part of the the late part of the 60s through to the 70s, there was a strand of psychotherapy which was actually trying to get you to change the person you are.
Yeah.
And some of that, I mean, looking back at it now, was not as successful as...
No, it was horrific, actually. Yeah.
Well,
they came up with the thing, well, they discovered false memory syndrome, and this was happening after this era, when people were going through professional psychotherapy,
yeah,
and having, through discussion, were having basically embedded false memories of how they grew up, and they were coming up with stories about abuse when they were children.
Blimey, that's weird, isn't it? There was an awful lot of stuff that happened in terms of experimenting on, I think it was soldiers. I mean, maybe sometimes with drugs, but also with isolation techniques and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But that actually happened a little bit later on in American history, only a few years.
Mm.
It sort of, this is when it all came to light in the early 1970s, and it was quite a scandal.
Mm.
And I wonder, and I am assuming that actually it had reached a point where it was becoming uncovered, and in fact it had been going on for some years. And I am wondering whether or not maybe Dagger of the Mind is perhaps an expression of this, perhaps not talked about, uncomfortable strand within the American establishment that was treating people in this manner, but at the time was still very much a taboo subject.
Yeah. I think finger on the spot, well, a nail there, because remember there's a lot of entertainment this sort of time.
Sure.
When we had things like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and, you know, there's a lot of...
popular book, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and obviously the LSD stuff.
That's an interesting aside, because obviously one of the most powerful pieces of treatment in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is electroshock therapy, which is often used as a symbol of a very, very bad therapy in films and television, even though technically it works very well, and it has been shown to work very well and is still in use today. But it was sort of highlighted in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as something that just basically fries out.
And it's very similar to the technique here.
And it is very, very similar. Yeah, and it's used in that horror aspect. And the whole episode is the locked in an asylum episode, very much akin to the episode we discussed last time, Who Gods Destroy. where and there are lots of the costumes are the same and there's a lot of the props are the same as well. So and yeah, this whole thing of being in a chair with this thing on either side of you, or the lights up on the wall as well that they were used, being used to like change your brain or to immediately affect your brain.
Well, I think there's also the case with hypnotism at the time, because I mean, the old fashioned comics, you always had them back. Was it pages? You had those adverts. To hypnotize women to like you.
Yeah. You know, the hypno disc.
The hypno disc, yeah.
And it's $1.99. Sort of,
you know,
the X-ray specs.
X-ray specs, of course, yeah. You know, and I suppose that shows you the sort of culture that they were, you know, we were all living in that sort of time. Well, we weren't born then, actually, when this episode
was out. I suppose it is part of the time, because they thought mind control was a thing. I mean, there was lots of things.
Maturing candidate.
Yeah. Brainwashing and things like that, which was a big thing in the Cold War. They thought that brainwashing was a serious thing. And that obviously explained as well why double agents existed as well, because they would think, well, why on earth would anybody want to work for the other side when... Because of all the propaganda.
Very soon after, I mean, obviously we had the assassination of JFK, you know, and obviously there's all that sort of, the start of the conspiracy theories obviously were happening around that with Harvey Oswald, and, you know, was he a brainwashed Manchurian candidate and all that sort of stuff. It's very interesting.
Manipulation of the mind. Interesting in the, it's not exactly a B-plot, but Dr. Van Gelder is on the... on the ship. The reason why they've gone down to the hospital, to the prison, I should say, is to investigate the allegations made by Dr. Van Gelder, who has been driven mad by this device. Mm-hmm. Has he been driven mad? He's been conditioned thoroughly that to try and implicate Dr. Adams in anything causes him intense pain. Morgan Woodward plays Van Gelder. He turns up in the second season.
Someone's used the device on television.
It's a notoriously unpopular episode, and so maybe I have been conditioned to feel pain every time I try and remember what it is. He's a captain of the starship Exeter, and it's the one where it's the one with the Yangs and the comms.
Yes.
And I have forgotten what it is.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it's the one with the big speech at the end, one of the cheesier big speeches at the end. Anyway.
The Omega Glory?
The Omega Glory. Yes. Thank you. See, you obviously haven't been commissioned. Well, we'll see about that. You will remember, you will forget the Omega Glory. Absolutely superb performance, it has to be said, by Morgan Woodward, who had to have a rest for 4 days
afterwards.
He was exhausted.
I'm not surprised.
Don't blame me, they were.
I'm not a criminal! I do not require neural neutralizer!
Neural neutralizer. Can you explain that, Dr. Van Gelder?
A device, door, control pad. Light!
This room. What happens there?
Anyway, so getting back to what I was saying, mind manipulation it applies there also because Spock mind melds. With Van Gelder, and this is one of the reasons why this is an important episode to discuss is because this is the first episode in which we see a mind meld in Star Trek, it's quite interesting, not quite the customary entrance or opening of a mind meld, the whole my mind to your mind, our thoughts to your thoughts to my thoughts, that kind of thing. That's not there.
Your body floats. Yes, I begin to feel it. Open your mind. We move together. Our minds sharing the same thoughts.
That's a spirituality sort of thing that they added to it. But this was more of a superpower.
Yeah.
You know, and he mentions, Spock does mention that sort of you know, to Dr. McCoy, you know, don't worry, this isn't hypnotism, it won't hurt you. Well, you know,
it's interesting that, because the writers, the producers were concerned, and it goes ties in with what you guys were talking about the concerns around this sort of thing in the public, and particularly about brainwashing and hypnotism, is that it had been considered that Spock would hypnotise Van Gelder, and they were concerned that by doing so, they would actually hypnotise some of the viewers who were watching that.
Wow.
Now, I suspect that's bollocks.
It is, utter bollocks. But that, was a fear that was actually built up by stage hypnotists when they were on television. And they would say, look, don't worry, these people have all been hypnotised before they've come out on stage. So
it's all part of the act.
So all part of the act, but to try, but also to show that actually hypnotising someone is actually a long, slow process, and it takes quite a little while.
Yeah.
And it's very, very dull, and it's meant to be dull.
yeah. But it's a great, it's really good. I mean, Leonard Nimoy does the mind meld thing very well. It is quite different. It becomes finished over time, but... it's really good, but it does tie in, doesn't it, to that to this whole theme that we've got going on about control. Only this one is obviously significantly more benign than the abusive way.
Of course, the whole thing about control and abuse of power is also touched in another way in the relationship between Kirk and Noelle.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because I wanted to talk about that next. And here we are.
Dr. Helen Noelle, Captain. We've met. Don't you remember? The science lab Christmas party?
Yes, I remember.
You dropped
in. Yes, I remember.
Problem, Captain.
Mr. Spock, you tell McCoy that she had better check out as the best assistant I ever had.
We are introduced to Helen Noelle. She's a psychiatrist, an eminent psychiatrist. She's a doctor, no less. And played by Mariana Hill, the beautiful Mariana Hill, I should say.
I always looked at her and I thought she was like a young Gina Davis. And she also has very similar sort of, dictation.
Her cadence of her voice is similar to Gina Davis.
Yeah,
you're quite right.
And she's a startling woman, you know.
Yes, striking woman. And obviously caught the eye of Captain James T. Kirk at a Christmas party.
Well, it did at one time, but he was so, at the beginning when they've introduced, he was so upset that she was assigned to him by Dr. McCoy.
Yes.
You know, he was...
She thinks McCoy's getting one up on him by assigning her to him, which I sincerely hope isn't the case, because, you know... He did ask for a psychiatrist to go down. There can't be that many on them. How many psychiatrists do you need on a ship? Mind you, this big metal box floating through space with 400 people in it. I think you probably need quite a few psychiatrists. Yeah.
But she's probably a forerunner to sort of Deanna Troi later on, that sort of character. Mm. You know,
So that's a good.
But it was supposed to be Janice Rand.
Oh, was it?
But it wasn't. By that point, Janice Rand was.
On the way out.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I mean, the impression that I got from it is what happened is that he's gone to the Christmas party, the science lab Christmas party. He's had a couple of Saurian brandies, and he's probably said something inappropriate to a junior officer, isn't he? Yeah. It's probably what it is, and I think that informs the kind of relationship that they have. You know, that kind of tension that's there. It's clearly an attraction. But he is, you know, he's the captain and he really isn't supposed to do that. And perhaps you're even getting the impression that actually that Helen could have probably got him into some trouble.
Well, trying that stuff out with a psychologist is perhaps, you know, that's even asking for more trouble.
Yeah, indeed. I thought that it's an interesting, because I mean we have spoken and probably will speak about the portrayal of women in Star Trek, the original series, and I realise that it is not always great. If this was a feminist podcast, we'd be using the word problematic a lot during it, as along with the words unnecessary and totally as well. And we'd be right to as well. Mm. Helen Noel, when they're experimenting with the neural neutralizer, decides to implant a sort of sexual fantasy into Kirk's mind, which...
A false memory.
A false memory, yeah. And I don't think that reflects very well on the writers, because mm-hmm. and I think that, you know, the idea of a female character who is incapable of just being professional and in doing this, you know, this thing at this time, just...
Yeah, I mean, you can fudge it by saying, well, maybe she was testing the limits of it.
Ooh.
And mm-hmm. because if you can put a fake... It's one thing saying you're hungry, it's another thing actually giving someone a desire or giving someone...
It backs fire on her as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It does.
Well, something like that would do. I mean, she would know that, wouldn't she?
But you had a very interesting sort of theory about Kirk throughout the whole of the series from here.
Well, from then on, yeah. Well, of course, because you know, she implants the thought in his head that he's hungry and that never goes away.
And that's why his waist expands throughout the next...
Yeah, because Noelle does manage to talk Kirk around and persuade him that actually, look, you're not in love with me. I've just planted this in. Do you remember? But she didn't say, look, you're...
No, exactly. You're not programmed
you're not
fully.
Hungry. You're not hungry. And sadly, we saw the... We saw the results.
Well, I was just going to do a little tidbit about Marianna Hill, because the actress who played Dr. Noel, she was actually Marianna Schwarzkopf.
Oh, yeah.
So she was actually a cousin of Stormy Norman.
That is one of the best facts I think we've ever come up with. I love that. Yeah. Cousin of Stormy Norman.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, it's a good one. And also, it's actually quite funny that she was also an actress, like a lot of actresses at the time and actors, who ended up going through the Mission Impossible and...
What's that whole Desilu thing?
Yeah, the Desilu thing. Yeah.
And all the way through to things like Columbo and everything like that. And there is an episode of Columbo called Dagger of the Mind.
There is indeed. Yes, indeed. And so, if you're a Columbo fan... We apologise, but we did say right from the off that this was a Star Trek podcast, not a Columbo podcast.
We did talk about Columbo in the last podcast, actually.
Did we?
Yes, we did. Yeah. Oh, so this, so
we,
this well, is actually...
We're obviously building up to a Columbo podcast, yeah? Okay. Yeah. It was not like we're not doing enough podcasts, isn't it? Just going back to that, the neural nuclear, just talk a little bit more about the production rather than necessarily the themes.
Yeah.
The neural neutralizer. You and I, Graham, are big. In fact, all of three of us actually here are big fans of the movie The Ypres File.
Mm.
Did you get that vibe when watching that?
Funny
if I didn't.
You didn't. No.
I'm a massive fan. You know, I didn't actually think of that, but you're right. It just is so bloody obvious.
Yeah, the whole listen to me.
Well, it goes in that whole brainwashing thing. You see it in Bond films as well. So it can ease that sort of, that sort of overpowering God voice there. Listen to me.
I was reading a review about this episode. There's quite a lot of sort of like references in classical literature and things like the Tantalus, which has got I think in ancient Greek legends or something like that. And
well, Tantalus was actually a person. It was a sort of demigod who was imprisoned in Tartarus. Tartarus is the Greek underworld, which was also served as a prison, and obviously this is a penal colony. But funny enough, in the last podcast we did, Whom Pods Destroy, the name of the planet is...
Elba 2.
And that
was the place where Napoleon was exiled.
Yeah, so again, there's the theme of prisons. And either places of places where people got forgotten and pushed... sort of excluded from society.
There's some significance to the name Lethe as well, the character Lethe, who plays a...
Well, that means forgetfulness, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And obviously she's had her brain completely wiped because of what an awful thing that she did. She's the one who just keeps saying, "Hey, lab may work."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This episode is also gloriously lampooned in an early episode of South Park. Have you guys seen that?
No,
Roger Ebert needs to lay off the fatty foods is the name of the episode, and it's set in the South Park Planetarium, and called the Tantalus Planetarium, and Dr. Tristan Adams is there, complete with his uniform and everything.
Oh, really?
And he brainwashes the visitors of the Planetarium, as he keeps calling it. He drops the T and calls it the Planetarium, and he brainwashes all the kids from South Park into wanting to go to the planetarium all the time in order to keep it open by using a mind control in the actual top of the planetarium stuff while they're watching the really bad display.
Track that down.
It's quite funny. I mean, South Park is not for everyone. So,
no.
But I mean, it is for me. I have to say.
I must make a suggestion that sort of at some point we should do a podcast on references in modern cartoons.
Oh, yeah. Well, we could do an entire Simpsons podcast, couldn't we?
Futurama.
Or Futurama. Yeah. Arguably, this is a Futurama podcast, isn't it? Yeah.
There's all these connections for the things we're doing. Yes. Because, like, Whom Pods Destroy, obviously, was a quote from, you know, an old sort of probably a Greek
poem. Whom Gods Destroy, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. You got me this time.
So I thought I did mine perfectly.
Yeah. No,
you did, yeah. But, you know, again, Dagger of the Mind is actually a quote from Macbeth.
Macbeth?
Yes.
Yeah. Is this a dagger I see before me? Indeed.
Or just a dagger of the
mind. Well, actually, it's later on. This is interesting thing because the line is from later on, the bit about Dagger of the Mind. A dagger of a mind, a false creation. So it's the idea about false creations, illusions, and stuff like this. And this is what is happening with the machine that's actually been used on Kirk and Van Gelder, you know. So there we go.
I wonder how this an episode of this type would be made nowadays. What themes people would concentrate, because as we've discussed, the whole thoughts of mind control and an alteration is something that was big in the 60s, and I wonder how in the modern times of fake news and things like that people would be using something like this, something would a device that suppresses memories or changes
what
memories.
I found was very interesting is that in modern times, you know, hypnotism has been totally we don't have it as entertainment anymore.
No,
you know, you don't see any proper sort of hypnotist on the stage,
so apart from Paul McKenna.
Well, you don't see him at all. He's a bloody DJ now. He always was
a DJ, and then he became a hypnotist, and then he started selling self-help books. We mentioned him on The Sound of Football the other week.
Yes, we did.
Did you? Oh, okay. You know, sorry, guys. He's got to you, too. To that one. Oh, my God. But no, you don't see many of these hypnotists.
No, you don't. No, you
not
don't.
Even McKenna.
But it's like jugglers, you don't see many of those, and they used to be on telly when we had three channels.
You know, but it's quite interesting how sort of modern perceptions of things do change, and like clowns, obviously, are seen as evil. Hypnotists, I thought the hypnotists, the start of the downward spiral of the hypnotists goes back to Big Train. When they used to do those, do you remember the evil hypnotist sketch?
He is an evil hypnotist.
And I mean, that was where it sort of started to go out of fashion. So
that is a hilarious thing.
I think if you're talking about the idea of mind control, then I think you've hit upon there's a good seed there with fake news. We haven't quite seen it yet, but the next tranche of socially relevant serialized fiction that we see, you know, probably starting sometime next year, we'll see a lot more about fake news, about perception control.
Yeah,
we've all watched Hypernormalization, right?
Yes.
Adam Curtis. Yeah, and about how the government and about how the state in general help people understand how the way the world works, or help people cope with the fact that the world is full of chaos by providing them with a series of narratives that don't accurately reflect the way the world is, but help stop us all from going mad or setting fire to our neighbours' houses and stuff like that. And I think that's probably how I would see there. But a big other dimension to this is the penal system. And this episode is also, I think, a statement about, perhaps a very, very diluted statement, but nevertheless a statement about the penal system, the American penal system, and about what happens to prisoners. And I thought Van Gelder's remark, you know, just toss me aside, you know, let someone else worry about it. That's how it goes. And there's still this idea that our people's unwanted, undesirables, the wrong'uns, and the criminals are still locked up in prison, and largely ignored because because they are. I mean, they are being abused by the Tristan Adams, and everyone is just trusting Tristan Adams that he's doing the right thing.
Well, remember right at the beginning, there is a conversation with McCoy and Kirk on the bridge.
There is. A cage is still a cage, Jim, he says.
You know, yeah. And that's quite interesting. I mean, again, this is it's funny how McCoy doesn't really get involved in this episode as much as well. So, anything to do with the mind, you know.
Anything to do with psychology. Yeah. No, that's not me.
Anything to do with medicine. I mean, he sets it up. Because he's the one who believes Van Gelder, and I think it's probably reasonable to assume that he would stay behind and allow. So I think this writer does a good job.
Yeah.
Espar David is the writer, and he does a good job in finessing that and going, well, yeah, let's send, because we want to send a love interest down. Well, he was going to be Janice. Let's send a love interest down for Kirk and give that story a bit of that dimension. And then with the justification for keeping McCoy on the ship is to look after and try and get through to Van Gelder.
Mm.
And it does play an important role. In earlier drafts, the mind meld thing doesn't happen. It's upstairs. I was going to bring it down. For the next episode, I might bring it down. I read the James Blish short story adaptation. Because there's no photo novel, so I thought, I'll have a look at that.
James Blish did a...
James Blish adapted all of the Star Trek episodes a series of short stories.
I didn't know that.
Did you not?
No, that's
not. Really? Wow, that surprises me.
Or maybe someone has used that machine on me. I probably did know it.
Does it cause you intense pain to think about?
Oh, I do remember. These are the paperbacks with the one, two, all the way
up. Perhaps doesn't get.
I do remember them now, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. These were them.
Those are the ones I do remember.
You remember them? Yeah. So they were. This is an American.
And I only had one of them.
God's Destroying It.
And I do remember they were. Yeah, the short stories.
Based upon earlier drafts, written well after they were transmitted, but still based upon earlier drafts.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent.
And the mind meld isn't in that one. They figure it out via getting through to Van Gelder through different means and working it out through there. So, it's a good state. It is a James Blish things are quite interesting reading.
I suppose, though, that in which case, because a lot of these things, like the mind meld, were used not because they thought it was going to be a better thing for the episode. It was just basically just to speed things along a bit, wasn't it, really? So,
but everything is, though, isn't it? Well, the transporter famously couldn't have the money.
So you can go into earlier drafts, which is what the writer actually wanted, the story that the writer wanted to tell. Actually, it's probably a better way of telling it, really.
I mean, like you, Graham, I'm sure, I don't know, did you read too many of those? I read a load of them because, I mean, it was the 80s. I hadn't discovered Star Trek, but my fandom was in its first flush, and anything related to Star Trek, I was just all over and obsessing about. So I read most of those James Blish novels. That could be a recurring theme because we're running out of photo novels, sadly.
Yes, sure.
But that said, I have read more than my fair share of novel adaptations of films in the 80s. Particularly reminded of the Terminator book. Which had all the stuff that came out in the later films.
Yes.
Okay.
About the scientists finding the arm of the and that was all in that adaptation because that was all meant to be in an earlier screenplay. And there was actually when the DVD finally came out of Terminator, it had all the deleted scenes that were actually included in the book. Yeah. And when I was reading that, it becomes
more like a Twilight Zone episode because you've got that paradox.
That sort of twist at the end where it goes, this is how it all sort of like one leads to the other.
Well, you know what, guys? I think what's happened here is I think that we've finished with this conversation because we've now started talking about something else.
we forgot about one thing, is that the Spock actually... Even though he had a very small part, you didn't see him on screen for a long time. The actual characterisation of Spock is actually very good in this, I think.
Yeah, go on.
You know, especially right at the end when he beams down, you know, and takes control of the situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, he looks, you know, very much in command and everything like that. And there, I think this is actually quite a good Spock episode.
Yeah.
You know, and even though... Well,
he's used sparingly.
He was used sparingly, but to great effect throughout all this.
Yeah, no.
You know, and... And you even have that the funny moment at the end where Spock finally catches up with Kirk and
yeah, that's right.
And you know, and obviously Kirk has jumped on top of her, you know, and Spock comes in, and the look of disappointment and disapproval, you know, is again and the funny news again, exactly again.
How many times am I going to have to get you out of this situation? You know. Yes, quite so.
But you know, overall, this was this is a fairly good episode. There's some good bits. There are some wonky bits, but Van Gell, the actor who played Van Gell, is brilliant.
Yeah,
and there is a. Now, I think that the actors throughout are really good. Hmm. You know, maybe Dr. Adams is a bit of a so-so villain.
Yeah, James Gregory, to name check him, the actor who played Tristan Adams. Yeah, I mean, he's quite an interesting character. Yeah. We haven't talked much about him as a character, have we? Because he comes across as being terribly benevolent, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
But he's got that evil side to him, clearly, or he is evil, or if or whatever we perceive to be evil. But, I mean, the thing is that we, even at the time, I remember watching this at the time, I remember thinking, this guy's a wrong'un. And I don't know whether that was because simply I've just got the legacy of Star Trek weighing on me, thinking there's going to be a wrong'un here somewhere, it's probably him.
Yeah.
Yeah. The kind of deception that maybe Van Gelder is the wrong'un.
Yeah.
Having escaped and all that. Because these characters... too sympathetically portrayed, in my opinion.
His eyes are just too crazy.
And his eyes are just too sweet, too crazy. And I can't understand, but absolutely sensational performance there. Absolutely brilliant.
He is, yeah.
And Tristan Adams, I think, yes, falls a little flat by the air. But
compared
to them. But still, yeah, still a worthy foe. And a lot of fun episode, and a significant episode. So, yeah, good. Okay, well. Thank you very much for downloading and listening to the latest edition of Whom Pods Destroy. We hope that you enjoyed it, and we thank you for listening this far. If you are listening to this on a web player, then you might consider subscribing on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or any other podcatcher of your choice. It's good for our algorithms, and it raises awareness of the show. And if you were so inclined to give it a favourable review, then it raises even more awareness of the show. And allows other Star Trek fans to become aware of this fine podcast. We will be back in a couple of weeks' time or so, in which time we will be talking about the first season episode, The Conscience of the King.
Ooh.
You may go, ooh, if you want to.
Ooh.
Yeah, okay. Well, that is going to be a genuinely exciting episode. We hope you'll tune in for that one and download that one there. So until then, from myself, Terry DeFallon, and from Graham Sibley, and from Derek Mantle, it's goodbye.
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 To all mankind, may we never find space so vast, planets so cold, heart and mind so empty that we cannot fill them with love and warmth.